Alright, welcome back to another fun-filled episode of Conspiranormal. It's your host, Adam Sane.
Your co-host, Luke and Duke.
And we got Rob over here on the soundboard listening in as ever. And tonight was, we hope will still be interesting. We're not sure what's going on. As promised, we were supposed to have Captain K on to talk about his experiences as a Marine on the planet Mars, protecting human colonies there, but I have tried to call Captain K. I've sent him a couple of emails. You know, I had this scheduled all the way back in the beginning of January with him, and as usual with guests, and our person on the line here can confirm this, I usually try to say, you know, are we still good about a week out or within the week before, and I've not heard from him. So he may pop in, he may not. So it is what it is. And there's the beep. but on the line, we do have Mr. Craig Ciccone. And I wanted to bring Craig on. We had you on back at the beginning of January. And it was a really good show talking about, like, the assassinations of the 1960s and Fred Hampton, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X. But I wanted you to come on to kind of address a something that we had said by one of our guests back on episode 69, which is Luke's favorite episode.
Woo!
And which was something that Dr. Fetzer, James Fetzer, you know, I had him on to talk about Sandy Hook. And we did talk about Sandy Hook, and we did talk about the Boston bombing. And it was a really interesting interview. But I had something that occurred that really, really bothered me somewhat, and that was this, how he was so quick to kind of go into what is, for lack of a better term, is Holocaust denial. And I know that Craig is a historian, and, you know, of course, I too am a student of history, so I kind of wanted to get him on to talk a little bit about kind of like the proofs for the Holocaust and what happened. And I kind of want to also go into what Fetzer said. So welcome to the show again, Mr. Ciccone.
Well, thank you very much. And howdy do to Luke and Rob.
Welcome back, man.
thank you very much. Now, it's funny, to digress just a little bit. You said that your guest was supposed to be Captain K. And immediately my mind went back to, and I don't know if this is before your time, guys, but there was around the same time as Monty Python and the Benny Hill Show, was a wonderful, wonderful British comedy show called the Kenny Everett Video Show. And Kenny Everett basically, it was, you know, skits and characters that he came up with and interspersed with videos. So he was basically precursor to MTV. But one of his cartoon characters was Captain Kremen. And so when you said Captain K, I just thought, are you talking about Captain Kremen? But you're probably not. That's very, very funny. So if you have a chance, though, go to YouTube and look up Kenny Everett, and he was one of England's funniest men ever. So
yeah, I think that is a little bit before. I never heard of. Of course, you know, Monty Python, Benny Hill, I've heard of. I'm sure most of
you're
these guys.
You're a comic book fan too, man.
Yeah.
I think the tradition of Monty Python, you know, just started the trend, and then you had people like Benny Hill and Kenny Everett, who grew up with that tradition of ingenious things that, you know, had never been tried before, and pushing the envelope and just absolutely hilarious. So, yeah, you guys should definitely check out Kenny Everett.
Got to complete irreverence.
Absolutely.
But I wanted to get into what Fetzer had said, and you said you listened to a little bit of it, and you didn't quite get into that far.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't get a chance. But I am familiar with James Fetzer because some of his work has also come into the JFK assassination research community. He's also done work on whether or not the Zapruder film is authentic. And how many shots hit Kennedy and from where, and how do we know that? So at least he does, you know, acknowledge that Kennedy is dead. So
yeah, there are
at least he's not a Kennedy assassination denier. Yeah. But Fetzer, unfortunately, is not alone. So even without him having been one of your guests or having even mentioned Holocaust denial, there are, unfortunately, as far as I'm concerned, too many people who if they don't deny, like I understand Fetzer, not deny, but challenge the final numbers, you know, how many Jews were killed. As far as I'm concerned, you get past one and it's too many. But we're talking about World War II here, so, you know, we quibble about the numbers and as if 1 million was far less worse than, say, 3 million or 6 million.
Right, exactly.
It's not. It's still a Holocaust. But there are people out there who do deny that it even took place, that not one Jew was killed because of some system that Hitler had in place to rid the world of Jewish industry, at least in Europe.
Right. And here's what he said about the numbers, specifically the 6 million number. He said that from, I believe he said like from 1890 on until basically 1940, he said that there were reports in Jewish newspapers specifically that 6 million Jews in Europe were in danger. That's what he was quoting. And apparently there was also a book, a Bible verse in Leviticus, which actually is not even a mistranslation or loosely translated. It's supposedly there's a symbol left out of the original Hebrew that is for six, that would be a symbol for six. And this is something that he didn't say, but this is something that I got from someone else later.
Right.
That's left out. So that's also supposedly that is a conspiracy from the Zionists to say that okay, there's six that six is left out of that Bible verse in the original Hebrew, and therefore, you know, 6 million were going to be dead, so they had to match up the number to that. Also, there was something about Zyklon B. And whether you could have in the supposed showers, if Zyklon B reacts with stone, it turns the stone pink. And supposedly there's no stone that is pink.
Okay.
I say, what else did he say? There was, the Red Cross also was another thing, that the Red Cross had gone into some of the camps and had said that there was nothing taking place. Now, the only camp that I know of that the Red Cross was ever let into by the Nazis, or specifically by the SS, was Theresienstadt, which was set up as kind of like a Potemkin village, like a mock. It's supposedly to say that all the Jews were okay. And I've actually shown Luke some film that was taken at Theresienstadt, where it shows the ball like playing tennis and listening to the orchestra. So that was basically, and some of this he was getting from, and like it seemed to me like he was kind of new, like it was kind of all new to him, and like this revolutionary thing for him, because he was getting it from this researcher that had also researched the 7/7 bombing in London.
Okay.
And this guy had apparently been also researching the Holocaust. And of course, there are people that will say that, you know, the Mossad was behind 9/11, the Mossad was behind 7/7 bombing in London. And that's probably where he's going towards. And also this idea that the Holocaust was basically used as Allied propaganda to Allied propaganda to offset the fact that they were killing so many Germans in World War II.
Right.
And they say, well, you know, the Jews died. It was because it's like the one matched the other. 6 million, 6 million Jews for 6 million Germans, even though 6 million Germans, I don't think, died.
Right.
But anyway, so, and also this idea that Zionists made up the whole thing so they could justify the foundation of the Israeli state.
Right. Sure. Okay.
So those are some of the points there.
All right. Well, I think it's important to right off the bat to talk about the exercise that we're even talking about as it is. It is incredibly important for us to examine history and historical investigations. Anytime something like this happens in history, especially something so catastrophic that so alters the course of history, absolutely, we should be making sure that things are accountable, or people are accountable, and that we can try to detect patterns that may or may not help us in the future. I mean, that's what the hope is, anyway, is that these patterns of behavior will not happen again, you know. The Great War, the war to end all wars, was just a precursor for the 20th, century. It was not the last war.
Right.
We didn't learn very much from that, unfortunately. So it's absolutely imperative that we study. This is why it's imperative that we study history and that we ask questions. Now, again, if you're going to quibble about specific things within a historical event, like the numbers or who is even behind it, then that we can have a rigorous debate about that. But we have to ask ourselves, as a people who aren't historians, Luke and Rob, sorry about that, you know, the ones who fell asleep in history class during high school, right? What is it that we demand of the historians? I mean, what's your bar, you know, to deny that something took place, even though the preponderance of evidence, the overwhelming evidence, shows that it did? I mean, we could say that about everything. How do I know that you, Adam, exist? You're a disembodied voice in Tennessee that I've never met before.
Right, exactly.
And so, you know, you want to get into the metaphysics of it and all that crap, but the point is we have certain standards. Now, historians are not scientists, but we try to adhere as closely as possible to a scientific method to show that the preponderance of evidence shows that this is what most likely happened. So when we have, like you said, films from each of these camps, not only from the different countries who were affected, certainly Germany, when the Allies dug out from the rubble their archives and things like that, because the one thing that can be said about the Nazis and specifically Hitler is they were absolutely fanatical about keeping a record. Because they thought what they were doing was historic, and it would last for 1,000 years. So they were documenting everything with films, with not necessarily documents, but certainly film. But we obviously we have the films, we have the testimony from the survivors. The Nuremberg trial, the entire thing was to find out the atrocities and who was responsible and how bad things got. So you want to quibble about the numbers? That's fine. But I don't believe that there's any amount of adjusting that you can do that would bring down the numbers significantly to deny that a Holocaust happened or an extermination happened or an attempt at an extermination happened. And even if Fetzer's point was I'm trying to think of one of the points that he made, having to do with our having to justify, like white guilt, which is certainly we can cite that as an example of how we've treated our black population throughout, you know, for 400 years is white guilt, but the guilt over us killing Germans, well, we didn't enter World War II because we had heard what Hitler was doing to Jews. As a matter of fact, we did not discover that until very late in the war. So it wasn't a justification for the war. And our bombing of Germany didn't happen in earnest until 1944. Our main thrust was getting Germany out of all of the European countries that he'd already conquered. So there was certainly enough justification for our involvement. There were certainly enough atrocities based on what the Nazi Party did and what Hitler did and the designs that he had for Europe, even if it didn't include the extermination of Jews, would have justified us going in there and being as aggressive as we were. And, of course, we weren't the only ones. The British had certainly reason to be very aggressive against Germany because of what Germany did to them.
Right. Yeah, the bombing there, yeah.
Absolutely, and the same thing about with the Russians. So using that as a justification for us being in the war, by any example, I don't think is a very strong argument. And the formation of Israel, of the nation of Israel, would have happened anyway, whether or not there was an attempt at extermination of the Jewish population or not. Would it have happened as quickly without the Holocaust? I'm not sure. We can't say for sure. But certainly, the way that we divided up Europe, the way that we treated our allies, as opposed to how we treated our enemies, like Germany, they were going to get a piece of it anyway. So using it as reparations of some sort, now that might have been, you know, a consequence of it, but it certainly wasn't a motivating factor, I don't believe. So, again, in my mind, in as we look back at that history, does it matter whether it was 4, 5, 6, or 7 million Jews? No, it absolutely does not. It was still an attempt at genocide that thankfully failed, but was unfortunately, before it was thwarted, was very successful.
Yeah, in a couple of points, one thing to make is that the footage that you see from the end of the war, those are actually not, and someone could say on the Holocaust denial part, could make this point and could say this, that, you know, those actually were not the death camps. The death camps had already been taken. Those were all out in the east. Those were all out in Poland and those areas. And most of what you see, the emaciated bodies stacked up in piles, that's all from Germany itself. But there's also the whole thing in Holocaust denial that what you see is victims of typhus or some other kind of disease. And as far as Israel is concerned, you know, it definitely gave impetus, the whole thing definitely gave impetus to the creation of Israel, because it got everybody on the side of starting a Jewish state, and it definitely, you know, increased the immigration to Israel.
Without a doubt. But we also saw the emergence of other countries. We've seen the emergence of other countries after every war, and even in quote unquote peacetime. So the emergence of new nations, it shouldn't be surprising.
And also, you know, the Nazis themselves, they wanted to cover up the whole thing. You know, they dug up bodies and burned them.
Exactly. I cannot remember how many of the camps that they had set up, which we have the architectural designs for. Those are some of the things that we discovered to make the disposal of people very, very efficient. Because when it first started, it was a slow, laborious process. They had underestimated how much work it would take to dispose of thousands and thousands and thousands of bodies at once. So they kept, re-engineering and kept, you know, improving on their plans and building new and better camps. And I can't remember how many they destroyed themselves when they knew that they were going to be overrun and were losing the war, how many they self-destructed. That we actually had to dig out rubble, you know, from the rubble, the evidence of what had gone on there.
Right. Because they were supposed to keep it all secret. They were going to keep it all hush-hush. And they told people that then they were going to move the Jews to the east for resettlement. That was they told the Jews themselves that.
Exactly.
And they told their own people that. One of the other points was made that Fetzer said was that the people were, that's exactly what happened, was that people were actually resettled in the east. Well, then if that is really the case, then where are those people? You know, those descendants would be somewhere. They would come forward by now.
Exactly. Part of the Nuremberg trials and the scholarship that came after that on its heels were population studies that were trying to pin a number to how many people were lost in the war. And again, this happens after every war. It's not just a certain ethnicity of people. It's you have to know. Emigrants and immigrants, and how are they moving, and how can countries, take care of people that are flooding in across the border to escape prosecution or persecution. So it wasn't just a study of the places that had been populated by Jewish people, like Poland, like Germany. It was all over Europe. They took the population censuses of all of the European nations and compared them with the studies that had gone before and the censuses that had been taken before. And that is how they get the round figure. It's one of the reasons, or one of the ways they get the rounded out figure of anywhere between 5 and 6 million people disappeared. There was no more record of them. Because Germany didn't just take these people, they took everything that they had, the property that they had, the history that they had in photographs or clothes or paintings or property or bank accounts or even papers, documents to prove that they, their lineage were taken and either destroyed or collected and distributed amongst the wealthy of Germany.
There was piles of stuff, piles of glasses, piles of shoes, toys, all this stuff that actually still exists.
That still exists, and people are still donating to museums and to libraries and things like that, absolutely. So if you were snatched off the street, Adam, and I hope, unless it's for alien abduction study like that. But if you disappear, your physical person disappeared, there would still be a record of Adam. There would still be proof that you existed. See, that wasn't the case. And that was part of the systematic destruction of people, not just that we're going to take them off the street or take them out of their homes and then kill them and we'll be done with it. But there still remains the remnants of these people that now we have to go and we have to destroy as well. So it wasn't just the obliteration of 5 or 6 million people. It was their identities as well, that they ever existed.
One of the things, too, that's interesting is that, we have the minutes of what is called the Wannsee Conference, and these were different people in the Nazi leadership. Reinhard Heydrich was the one that headed it up. He was the chief of the secret police in Germany,
right?
Which he was like Himmler's right hand man, and so we have the minutes of this conference between all these kind of like bigwigs in the government and in the military, and the SS. And people in industry of how they were going to pull this off, what they were going to do, and we have the minutes to this thing that were almost actually destroyed, but we actually have it.
Exactly. And how many more might we have found had those not been destroyed? So again, we're looking at patterns. We're looking at, this existed, or at least we recovered this particular document that was created and existed. How many more were out there, because this wasn't the only conference, it wasn't the only meeting, and it certainly wasn't the only minutes that were taken at these meetings. So we are fortunate to at least have this. And on this, on the basis of this, plus the testimony of the surviving SS officers, plus, other people who were there, and so forth and so on, again, it's the preponderance of evidence that shows that this absolutely did happen. And we can't ask history for any more than that.
Just ask Luke if he wants to ask something. He's just shaking his head. He's like, he's totally confused.
I was just thinking the other day, I'm just going to go ahead and embarrass myself even more. I was thinking the other day that
we'll get some more emails.
I don't even know why the First World War even started, or the makings of the second one for that matter. I don't even know like what countries were involved and why it even started.
Right. Are you saying you want your history lesson now?
Well, I guess a short one would be
that. Yeah, it's kind of a long one.
Well, the start of World War I was a little bit more complicated than the start of World War II. And there are historians that debate what it was. Was there one particular thing that set it off, or was it a chain of events, of miscommunication, of misinterpretation? You know, the assassination of Franz Ferdinand is usually cited as the spark that lit the fuse that then exploded into World War One. But it was international relations at the time, border countries that were having clashes. That basically would have been a civil war had not everyone thought, okay, let's throw our hat in too. So that was more stop and start as far as launching into World War One, and it kind of just snowballed, and then everyone's involved in, and no one's really sure why. You know, who threw the first snowball, right?
It was all these different military plans and all these military options, and if they didn't do something as soon as possible, then the other side might attack, and it was just who would blink first.
And the machinery also just
got out of hand.
Absolutely, and you consider the context of World War One, which was the Industrial Revolution. Now, all of a sudden, we have a new class of people. We have global influence like we never had before, as far as the speed, as far as the products that are involved. And now countries can really be powers. For the first time, different countries are vying for power. And that puts everybody on edge right there. You know, how is this good for us? How is this good for, you know, how is this going to advance our country? So you have that. And then, of course, you have Russia itself going through its own revolution. So, Slovenia is going through a revolution, and Serbia, and, you know, like I said, Russia, and then an industrial revolution on top of that. So everything is just chaotic. And so this kind of thing happens. Now, World War II is easy enough to map because it's how we ended World War One. We, to the victors goes the spoils of war. We completely spanked Germany. I mean, it wasn't enough that we defeated them and that we now control Deutschland, what used to be their huge empire. It's now we're going to not only carve it up into as many pieces as we can to make Germany as small as we can, but we're going to berate them. We're going to make them pay restitution in the millions of dollars, and at that time, I can't even translate what it would be in today's dollars, but it's like we demanded their land, their money, and that they couldn't have a police force of their own.
Let me jump in real quick and say that I think I read like in 2011 that Germany finally paid off the war reparations in 2011.
Okay, I buy that. Yeah. I didn't see that, but yeah, that's probably it.
Yeah,
that's probably it. But we put such a strain on them. They had basically no ability to rebuild. Now you could say that, well, they shouldn't have started this shit in the first place. Okay, they shouldn't have, but They did, and simply because they lost, are we just going to annihilate them as a country? But we didn't even give them a chance to rebuild. So already there was a lot of resentment the way they were treated after World War One. That, again, the momentum built, and this young Hitler, this young Adolf Hitler, who had designs and had patriotism and nationalism, that he saw the shrinking of the empire, of the Reich, that he knew and loved, that was being carved off and given to Poland, and yeah, you know, what he then turned around in World War II and claimed was the Jews. The Jews took everything, yeah. Right, of right. theirs. So they were going to do the same thing. So that snowballs into Hitler's designs to return Germany to their rightful land, which was Poland and, you know, Czechoslovakia, and, you know, and that they were going to be the Third Reich, the third dynasty in Germany's history, and it was going to last 1,000 years.
Oh.
And so that's what Hitler's motivation was to take back what was taken from Germany at the end of World War One.
So World War II, so Germany's solely responsible for the beginning of World War II then, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Because of their designs and what Hitler had in his plan for the German Empire to restore the mother country to its righteous global domination like they had done two times before.
And not to digress too much, but one of the Germany when they invaded right before they invaded Poland, they sent some Polish. They sent prisoners dressed in Polish uniforms to this German radio station right across the border and had them attack it. And then they said they attacked it, and they just left the bodies there and said that the Poles attacked German soil, so then they could have the excuse to invade Poland. False flag.
Yep, and Austria and you know, some of the other countries as well. Yeah, absolutely. So it does. Again, we're talking about the connection between then and now, and the patterns of history, and what can we learn from it. And if we learned by treating countries like this, even when they're defeated, because again, it's can you separate a government from its people? And that's a very sticky subject in a lot of historical events.
Right.
And do we blame? You know, Germany as a whole, including its people, for allowing it to happen. So we're just gonna, you know, it's like Cuba too. We didn't like Fidel Castro when he took over in 1959, so we were going to punish all of Cuba with all of our with our embargo.
The embargo, yeah.
Which made Cuba impoverished, which then, you know, which was felt not by Castro or his government, but by the people of Cuba. And the people
right.
of Cuba and didn't want him any more than we wanted him. But what were they going to do? So we look at how we treated Germany at the end of World War One and how that sparked World War Two, and it's the same thing with how did we leave Iraq?
Yeah.
What position did we leave Iraq in, especially when we claimed ourselves as being their liberators?
Look at what condition they're in now.
Exactly. It's how did we treat the Iraqi people or the country itself that we bombed repeatedly and destroyed, basically, and then left without reparation, without rebuilding, without restructuring, and basically left them more impoverished than they ever had under Saddam Hussein. And now look what's happening in the Middle East because of our footprint that was left there and how we treated a war-torn country. So,
I think Luke was asking what an embargo is.
That's like an imposed set of taxes, right?
You stop trade between the countries,
I understand.
Okay, I got you. Exactly. So it's you can't travel there. So there's no travel back and forth between the two countries, the United States and Cuba. No trading between the two countries, right? Which Cuba, of course, would absolutely rely on. Which is one of the reasons why so the United States doesn't like Cuba, or at least doesn't like Fidel Castro. So Castro has been cut off from the main export or importer, right? The United States. So he goes and looks for friends. And what friend does he find? Nikita Khrushchev in the Soviet Union. So then to make sure that his people do not, you know, suffer from poverty and hunger and things like that. He starts up a friendship with Khrushchev, which is our enemy. So then we look at Castro in with even more disdain and say, well, if you're friends with the Soviet Union, well, we'll just keep this embargo going and we'll tighten the screws and we will tell other countries not to trade with you because we're friends with everybody around the world, so we can squeeze you, right out of existence. So the alliance between Cuba and Russia was basically, they had no choice. We gave them no choice.
Right. They found a friend.
Which is why Cuba was the setting of the Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 62. So,
well, let me ask about, I want to ask about, Holocaust denial.
Okay.
And I want to ask about, it's kind of like a two-tier question. First of all, what has kind of generated Holocaust denial in your opinion? And then also, what is the appeal of it in conspiracy circles? And I know that's a world you've spent some time in.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious that you've probably encountered this many, many times.
Fortunately, I haven't, because the circles that I associate with and I work with are more reasonable than that. They're more rational than that. And we don't have to spend our time, tearing down paper lions or tissue lions that, these myths that this never happened or. I don't know what the benefit is. That's an interesting question. The benefit of course, looking at history and, making sure that, like I said, people are accountable and that we can rely on the history that is given to us and the records that are left for us and interpreted for us. That's extremely useful. To me, it's essential. But I don't know what the gain is. Maybe there is a certain popularity to it because it strikes a nerve. Not only strikes a nerve with Jewish communities, or certainly something as sensitive as that, right? It's easy to attack because, well, just like 9/11, that if you deny that something this horrific happened, then people react emotionally as opposed to rationally, and you can defeat people a lot more if they're emotional than if they're rational. So you almost piss them off to the point where you're the one who sounds rational. But I think it's the point that I alluded to before. It's part of the guilt. It's part of the guilt of whoever is in power, whether, again, we're talking about an authority or we're talking about a culture who's in power or who's dominated, that the tactic that they use to justify their power is to blame the victim or to question the victim. And we still do that today, don't we? With women, certainly, that's the one thing, the one that comes off the top of my head, that rape isn't legitimate because, well, she was asking for it. Rape must be legitimate because, apparently, and I didn't know this, women have uteruses that are so sensitive, it can tell between rapist sperm and non-rapist sperm.
Yeah, that's one of the Republican lines.
Exactly. In this day and age, they use such a term as legitimate rape. And he looks
over here looking befuddled. I mean, he's just...
I have never heard that in my life.
Yeah, that's actually been said. That's actually, yeah.
And it's still believed by people in the Republican Party. People, and when I say people in the Republican Party, you might think, oh, you mean people who hold placards? In rallies. No, these are senators and representatives that, quote-unquote, represent a segment of our population actually trying to convince other people that there is such a thing as legitimate rape. That if a woman gets pregnant, then she was not raped. because the uterus.
Yeah.
Well, but it's the same kind of mentality that we've used with Native Americans. We've used with African Americans. That when they rise up and actually get some political, economic, or cultural power, like Jews have been able to do, and that steps on some people's toes or interferes with some people's designs for their own power, whether it's political or cultural or economic, then it's victim baiting. It's turning to the victim and saying, oh, they're the cause of it. And so and maybe that's the allure of the Holocaust. We don't talk about our treatment of Native Americans very much anymore, do we?
Yeah.
We don't. Why? Because there are so few of them left to rise up and to gain political power.
They're all drinking fire water.
Well, there you go. I mean, yeah. I mean, they're so drunk, right? but who supplied them with the whiskey and hors d'oeuvres?
Right.
I mean, before then, all they knew was beaver and fish. All right? No disease, no liquor, no weapons, right, except to hunt with. But then these weird-looking dressed people, you know, come over, and they seem nice and cordial at first. But like you said, Adam, what did Germany tell their Jewish population? Yeah. How do you get that many people into camps and then annihilate them? You've got to placate them somehow. You've got to make them somehow willing to. So you tell them, oh, we're just relocating you. You're going to be in a labor camp, and you know that'll be that. What did we?
And when they were there. When they were there, they told him, when they actually were there, walking into the shower, they said,
absolutely.
You're going in for disinfectant, don't worry about it.
Absolutely. And so what did we tell Native Americans? Oh, you can have this land. I understand that we're displacing you from the East Coast, but we're going to move you over here.
Yeah, in the wastelands of America. Mm-hmm.
Right. And then 20 years later, we want that land. And, oh, you can have this land. And we promise this is the last time we'll displace you. You can have this land. And, you know, so we did. We completely took away any kind of power that they had or any kind of role that they could have played in an American society, because we demanded. What did we demand from all of our immigrants into this country was that you have to be American. You have to be like us. You have to speak English. You have to go to school. You have to pay taxes, no matter what. Well, Native Americans didn't want to do that. So instead of working with them or compromising with them, we just annihilated them and took away everything. So I'm sorry, Adam. Back to your question. I think most of it is guilt. Whether it's European guilt, you know, Anglo-Saxon, white European guilt for our sins, and it could be as simple as that. But what these people who deny that the Holocaust even took place, what that does for them, I have no idea. Yeah. I have no idea what gain that is, other than an audience just to see, because you know, like a crash of death or a crash of metal. We want to see how weird these people look.
Well, it seemed with Fetzer, and this comes out in the interview, it seems with him that, and you know, I don't want to use him as an example, but this is, you know, the closest I've been to exposed to it, as it seemed with him that some of it had to do with partly the problem with the Palestinians, the issue between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and the actual how badly the Palestinians are being treated, which is valid.
It is valid.
And also it had to do with just this kind of where he was feeling that he himself was being persecuted by quote-unquote Zionists. Like they were changing his Wikipedia page and they were saying that he was an anti-Semite and all this. Well, as soon as he said, like, you know, they're trying to call me an anti-Semite, then he starts talking about the Holocaust denial. So it was kind of like, dude, what's going on here, you know?
Right. That's a contradiction right there, and hypocrisy. So, but
the Palestinian thing is an emotional issue with some people. It really is.
It absolutely is an emotional issue. Do you know how long it's been an emotional issue? For thousands and thousands of years. So so to pinpoint this as either a further justification or as a motivation, I just think it's displaced. I don't think that the argument is strong enough. Now, again, we want to talk about the relation between Palestine and Israel. Yeah, absolutely. And where the United States fits into it, or where any other country fits into it. Yeah, that's a rigorous and important debate. But it's not going to be solved or alluded, enlightened in any way by saying that that the Jews just made it up so they could justify having their own land.
Yeah,
and continue to. And so the reason that they're having, you know, their disputes is because of this damn Holocaust thing, which never happened.
Right.
Well, did you ever get any more hate mail?
No, actually, I got one person that sent me an email about Fetzer and said, "What a disgusting man." I guess he denies. It was something about women.
She said, I bet he also condones stoning women to death.
Yeah, that's it. He also condones. I don't even know where that came from.
It was Heather, man.
If you're an anti-Semite, does that make you a pro-Christian? And if so, you know, yeah, how far do you take your Christian interpretations of the Bible and of, you know, tradition and things like that? That leads to stoning, because they still do that in the world today. So,
they sure do. I thought I was going to get so much mail about that. I already had gotten like one email, the lengthy email about how somebody didn't like Luke because he believes in population control.
Yeah,
but
look at how much I care.
And so I thought, oh man, the emails are going to start pouring in, you know, because we're on a network. Fringe Radio Network is mostly a lot of like evangelical Christian and a lot of people that would probably support Israel more so, and so I thought, oh man, here it's going to start pouring in on us. But nothing, just that one person. Maybe they just haven't gotten to episode 69.
Maybe they just stopped listening.
Or maybe they're avoiding episode 69 because, you know, of the implication. So,
and everything else that he talked about in it. I mean, you know, we talked about Sandy Hook, and he made some good points about Sandy Hook. He made some good points about Boston bombing. Some of his stuff, he does go a little just kind of out in left field a little bit. I mean, he talked like the 9/11 stuff. I mean, he really kind of firmly believed that the planes were holograms. And I'm like, that is not the simplest explanation. I'm sorry.
It really isn't. That's by far.
And I think that he also said that it was a small, like, antimatter weapon or something that blew the towers up. Also, not the most simplest explanation.
Right. Right, because you know, fortunately, unlike the Kennedy assassination, it was filmed extensively, professionally, and with, you know, amateurs that have been collected and studied, and you have to take all of them. You know, with the Kennedy assassination, the government was very good at collecting everything and then releasing only what they wanted to. You know, but the same thing with 9/11. So again, you talk about the similarities between the Kennedy assassination and 9/11, but searching for the most complicated answer, just either to sell a book or to advance, you know, yourself in some way, it's just counterintuitive. We don't have to get all emotional about it, because I am not so invested in my beliefs that I would feel somehow insulted if someone challenged them. I'm all about rigorous debate, and I am sorry to hear that you didn't get more emails, because that's the whole reason you have a podcast, is to get people talking about things and to get people to think about things.
I want to piss people off. Hey, that's why Luke's here.
I've got
some good ideas, dude. Most of the time, I just keep my mouth shut. But
well, yeah, because there's only so much that can be accomplished with you know being politically correct or you know not wanting to offend anybody or politely asking, well, what do you feel about this? No, sometimes you do have to shake the shit out of people because we are so complacent. And because our attention span has been so dwarfed by, you know, well, many different things, but yeah, sometimes you just want to, you know, slap people and say, hey, this stuff matters, you know?
Yeah.
Do I have to insult you to get you to speak? You know?
Right, exactly.
So, yeah, I do think there is some validity in the argument that, if I don't piss people off, then I haven't done my job. The whole idea is to instigate at least discussion. And sometimes people are slow to react or slow to get involved or slow to, you know, concern themselves beyond their own little security bubble.
Well, let me ask you about something controversial. You know, you are in Detroit. You are close to Dearborn.
Yes.
Which is the largest Arab population in the United States?
Outside of the Middle East, absolutely.
Right. And it is, this is a bone of contention now, especially with kind of like a lot of things that are going on down here in Tennessee. You know, we have like the whole Murfreesboro mosque thing, the whole anti, you know, in fact, we had a couple of years ago here in Nashville, the anti-Sharia law conference.
Right.
And it's kind of a twofold question. You know, do you see a lot of this kind of like insidious Sharia law kind of creeping in on you up there in Detroit? And also, have there been any like reactions from people against that Muslim community up there?
Yeah, I mean, certainly that was the huge concern with after 9/11. There were huge rallies and meetings that took place ostensibly to calm the community, more of an inclusive, let's get together and talk about this, because if we just stay in our separate camps and let things fester, nothing good will come of that. So, you know, it's important not to connect this event with a certain segment of any population. Whoever was behind 9/11 does not speak for, you know, a vast majority of anybody. So, when things happen in the Middle East, certainly we somehow see a connection to that. But that's why it's absolutely important that whether we're talking about religion or we're talking about race, so-called race, which have been hot button topics. For a long time, it's been taboo. I mean, whether it's been money or it's been sex or it's been language, certainly religion and so-called race have been so taboo is because there are so many, like I said, guilty feelings about it. Certainly stereotypes that are a lot easier. When you see someone who's different or you hear someone who's different, well, let's put him in a category so they're really easy to spot, so we know it's who's us and who's them. And I always find it interesting that, especially between Islam and Christianity, that I really believe we're talking about the same God. If that is what you believe, we're talking about the same God. Maybe not the same, lineage from God, or, you know, the same prophets from God, but ultimately, you know, we have more similarities than we have differences. And unless we talk about it, we'll never know that. It's the same thing with so-called race and our race problem, right? You talk about it being controversial because we do not engage it enough. We simply allow emotions to take over and, you know.
Yeah.
That replaces rational thought. So to answer your question, here in Dearborn, I think we've acclimated ourselves, we've infused ourselves with each other's cultures enough that we're not that reactionary So that's why we haven't had,
events like attacks and
attacks or retributions or things like that, or go home, go back to where you belong, that kind of thing. Thankfully, we haven't. It doesn't mean that we are immune to it, certainly by any means, or that we somehow that we are the that we're the pillar of cultural, religious, and racial tolerance. We got a long way to go. Because how is it that we can accept an Arab community or a Muslim community, a Polish community, a Mexican community, a Greek community, all here in Detroit, right?
Yeah.
But yet we still can't treat black people with the same type of humanity. So we still have a long way to go, but we're better in some areas than others. But we should always be willing to talk about it.
To learn,
I've heard this before, but you tell me. We've got to, as Malcolm X said, and I'm glad I can mention Malcolm X, because unfortunately we had the 50th anniversary of his assassination yesterday. But one of Malcolm's most lucid points was, well, he was asked, well, how is this so-called race problem ever going to be solved? Because, at the time, he's in the Nation of Islam, and he's Elijah Muhammad's number one representative, and he's doing a lot of speaking. But what he's speaking about is separation, that blacks and whites must separate completely. And so that made people say, how do we solve this problem then? And he says, it is not going to be solved until we sit down at the same table and be able to talk and ask questions without offending the other person. I truly believe that we are.
It's easier said than done sometimes, though.
It is easier said than done, but again, it's that culture of you can't talk about that because we might insult somebody.
Question he wanted to ask.
Yeah, I just want to know. I'm sure both of you guys know this. What are the two different groups of Islamic people called? Like, what is the activist group called, and what is like the more passive? We'll have our beliefs, you have your beliefs, group of Islam called. I know that they have names for them. I've heard it before.
But. Well, you got Islamic fundamentalists, which you have fundamentalists about any religion.
Exactly. Adam, you hit it right on the head with any religion. But I think what you're asking is there are two different sects of Islam. One is Sunni and one is Shia. And Malcolm was a Sunni Islam. And I do not have the knowledge to speak confidently about the differences between the two.
It's complicated.
It is complicated, yeah. Unless you're well grounded in it, because there are nuances and there's history involved, and it depends on who you're talking to or talking about. But it's interesting though, because again, we need to talk about Islam as a religion, right? But we don't want to talk about Christianity as a religion. Anytime a comedian mentions it, anytime Bill Maher mentions it, even though he's an atheist, but it's still certainly part of the conversation. We just shut up. We just cringe. We don't, And for some reason, you talk about extremists. We had extremists here in the United States, but no one ever said that the Ku Klux Klan acts on behalf of all the Christians in the United States, even though they claimed they were a Christian organization. So here we have a terrorist organization in the Ku Klux Klan claiming religious superiority, a religion that we all know about, Christianity, but yet no one is saying, when they burn crosses on people's front lawns,
And hang people and tar and feather them.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what Christians do. Yeah. That's my bag. So when we have extremists like ISIS and or ISIL or Boko Haram or any of them, that does not mean that they are acting in accordance with all of the other believers of Islam or Muslims. So we've got to be very careful about that, about what does it represent? What does it truly represent? Does it represent these people, these select few people, or does it speak more broadly to the beliefs of Islam? That's why we have to have this conversation. And to be really, it's going to seem like I'm really off topic here, but I can't watch it without just being without just being flabbergasted at the lack of foresight or even our ability as Americans to be reasonable. How many Luke and Rob and Adam? How many of you guys are Beatle fans?
Well, I am.
I like them okay.
Luke's into Beatles. Swedish satanic metal. So
what the Beatles?
Well, I like all metal.
Well, okay, but even if you're a casual Beatle fan, what was the most controversial thing that ever happened when they were a group?
Well, that would be in John Lennon, the Jesus comments.
Yeah,
we're bigger than Jesus. Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, the Southern Belts, they went out of their minds, even though John Lennon explained what he meant, that it was in the paper quoted out of context. So he gives them the context, says, I did not mean to say that we are better or greater than Jesus Christ as a person or God as a thing or whatever he is. I simply made an observation about the value system of... Well, he was actually talking about people in England, which is still true to this day. The Church of England has come to mean so little over all these years that the Beatles at that time were more popular in England to the kids than Jesus Christ.
Right,
so he explains all that, and they still had Beatle boycotts, they still had Beatle bonfires, where these people who would not listen to reason took all of their Beatle mementos and burned them in this huge, you know, complicated... that's what you do with someone who you don't agree with? Burning is, the effigy is the most effective way to deal with someone you don't agree with?
Yeah.
It's happened, like I said, over 50 years ago, or not quite 50 years ago, and I'm still physically how could you not listen to the guy who said it? He wasn't trying to backtrack, he wasn't trying to, not offend anyone. He gave you an explanation as to why he said it, but because he mentioned Jesus Christ, and popularity with a cultural icon like the Beatles, they went out of their minds. They absolutely lost it.
Kind of reminds you how certain Muslims are
exactly
going out of their minds about pictures and cartoons of Muhammad.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So extremism, this kind of extremism, can happen in any kind of religion, and as long as we know that going in. But it's the reasonable. It's the people who actually. The vast majority of people who are Christians, yeah, who are Muslims, who are Jewish, who are Buddhists, who are, what was last controversy over Buddhism or Hinduism?
Yeah.
None.
Yeah. True. Luke, did you have a question you wanted to ask?
My question earlier was just like, I thought that there was a sect of Islam that were all radicals. But you guys' answer shows that, like, in all of those sects or the two, there are still extremists between the two.
Well, there might be separate organizations, but
exactly. You hit it right on the head. The different organizations. What a lot of people don't understand is Christianity itself is divided into two sects. One is Catholic, and one is Protestant. And under Protestant is everything else, whether it's Lutheranism, whether it's evangelicalism, Episcopalian, Mormons, Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I mean, all of the different Christian or quasi-Christian groups fall under the Protestant category of Christianity. So there's Catholics and there's Protestants in Christianity.
I got you.
Same thing with Jews, whether you're Orthodox or conservative, and then of course in Islam with Sunni and Shia. So,
Craig, I want to we're kind of running out of time, and I want to thank you for coming on and being kind of like a last minute fill. Well, not really last minute, since we talked about this 2 weeks ago.
Last ditch effort.
It's kind of good to have this discussion, and I'm glad that we've talked about the things that we've talked about.
No, absolutely. I appreciate you calling on me, and like I said, because this should be, we should be talking about all of these different aspects of human behavior and relationships, and because, again, we are on this earth to understand and to be understood. That's it.
Right. Right.
And we cannot do that if we do not have a rigorous and open, honest debate.
I agree.
I appreciate it.
Absolutely. There's so much stuff that we need to talk about. I mean, we need to talk about Ferguson. We should talk about 9/11, JFK.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'd love to have you and John on here to talk about some of that stuff. You know, both of you, we'd do like a tag team over here. But
That would be great.
Well, we're going to close out this segment, but do you have like any kind of like a... people could get in touch with you or see some of your work or like what's going on now?
Right now I have a blog that unfortunately I do not use as a blog. I just use it to promote the work that I've done on the JFK assassination. So it's Craig Ciccone at craigciccone.wordpress.com. But I'm in the process of actually getting a website so that people can read about the projects that I'm doing, can even contribute if they want monetarily, whether it's John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Fred Hampton, and even, I don't know if I told you or John told you, but I'm writing a book about Robert Palmer. You guys remember Robert Palmer?
Is this Robert Palmer?
The musician.
Okay, Addicted to Love?
Addicted to Love, Robert Palmer. Yeah.
Okay. Because there's one that was a music critic, and there's another, the one that was the singer.
Right. No. This is the English musician. Yes. So I'm going to have this website where my projects that I'm working on are all there, and contact information is I believe on my blog right now.
Cool. Excellent.
Yeah.
When do you expect to have the Fred Hampton book out?
That's a very good question. I have been advised to do a Kickstarter campaign to try to fund the rest of my research to get that going. I really don't know how long it's going to be. If I get the materials that I've been working at getting. The writing shouldn't take very long because it's been 23 years in the making. But then finding a publisher and then getting it out to people, that who knows how long that's going to be.
Yeah, I have another friend of mine that's also been on this show that is kind of experiencing the same kind of thing. He's writing like a 7-book opus on the war on terror. So
yeah, wow.
From a Christian point of view.
Right.
About the future.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Craig, thank you so much. Stay on the line for us, and we're going to close out this segment on Conspiranormal.
All right, and welcome back, you conspiracy weirdos. I hope you got your jollies off on all that conspiracy talk. Well, actually, most of it was mainstream history. Which I enjoyed because, like I said, I'm really spotty on my history, so it's always good to brush up on all that, huh?
Right, exactly. Well, Craig did a really good job. Of course, I was really happy to have him on. I mean, originally that was just going to be about a 20-minute segment, and then we were going to talk to Captain K about his experiences on Mars. But I think Captain K might be back on Mars because I've not not heard from the guy at all.
Yeah,
so.
I have to go on record to say I'm officially bummed. I was looking.
Yeah, I know you were, and I think that I'm a little bummed myself, you know. But I actually was really liked to what Craig had to say, and we got into some good topics that I really want to get into. But we got to get some like weird people on here, more oh, yeah, weirdness, for sure. You know. We got to get. I will try to get in touch with Captain K. Definitely, got to get the guy that's obsessed with Tiffany on it, you know.
Maybe we can make like a three-way call between the two.
Yeah, we could. Anyway, Captain K does have a web presence, something like earthcitizens.com. So he has some things that he sent out a newsletter online. I'm on his mailing list. So I wanted to read just a little bit of it. Just a little bit of it. Okay. Just kind of give everybody a teaser whenever we actually will get him on. So, friendly versus hostile ET species. You have mentioned reptilians, Draco, human military, and other types of aliens. Recently, you spoke of some bronze ETs as well as Saurians, Arcturians, Andromedans, and also a black-cloaked, shadowy head figure, which you later realized was an aged reptilian masquerading as a powerful Dark Lord. Can you speak more about the bronze beings, as well as which ones you consider to be enemies to humanity, and which ones are neutral or even benevolent to humanity?
Oh my god.
And feel free to jump in anytime, Luke, because I know you love this
These
stuff.
Dudes are on a whole different level. I thought the Ashtar Answer. Command was cool.
Answer. Now, Captain K knows, because he was on Mars fighting these guys. The bronze ones refer to themselves as the grandchildren of the great dragon Li. They believe that the galaxy is sentient, and that their job is much like white blood cells in the body of the galaxy. Their goal is to rid all planets in the galaxy of cancer and disease, as they put it. We humans are neither to them. We are a part of the Gaian ecosystem, which should have the opportunity to flourish, but infections by other species and by a sociopathic strain in our own species threaten the whole ecosystem of the entire planet and subsequently the entire solar system and this corner of the galaxy, potentially. The bronze ones would like to stop what is here before it spreads, culling back the population, there you go, Luke, to a few hundred million and starting over is an option for them. But they consider it very wasteful, and would prefer to save the species as is while removing the harmful components, much in the same way a surgeon would rather perform a delicate and complicated surgery to save the whole patient.
I like these bronze guys.
But would, there you go. But would amputate both arms and legs to keep the patient alive if that was the only option left. The bulk of the manual, well, he goes into what, like the classifications.
Well,
he's got the draconian reptoids. The Zeta 1A and Zeta 1B species, often referred to as greys by civilians and as whites by insiders. The Haurians, Betelgeuse 3, and two others, listed. Why are you laughing, Rob? And as non corporeal, amorphous, shadow types A and types B. Several in the green category that I can remember would include, but not be limited to, and may have changed, Centauri, vegans, or vegans, I guess. Tau Ceti's.
Vegans.
Did you have some Tau Ceti on your way, or was that Taipu on your way in here?
Oh yeah, the Taipu cat.
Proscenians and some secretive warrior race called the AK-KA. I have no idea where the Akka are from, and no idea what they look like, but they were in the list and it stood out because it was weird. That's about all I recall off the top of my head. Dude. Mars Defense Force, operations and duties. Can you share some of the operations and duties you carried out while on the Mars Defense Force? Our primary mission was defense of Forward Station Zebra and grids 87 to 125 and 227 to 277 of the Mars colonies. Secondary duties were to aid other divisions protecting our defensive grid, and when organized by command, to assault or join other forces in assaulting native Martian hives of insectoids and reptoids. The two sentient species on Mars, other than us, are at least the only ones I had personal experience with. I've heard reports of one or two other native species on Mars. We mostly operated in powered armor, EV suit, using some sort of Gauss rifle or railgun as our primary field weapon.
We were kept busy. If we weren't fighting, we were training. We were given recreation time, but we spent an amazing number of hours training for future combat missions.
Whoa. You better hope. You better hope he doesn't listen to this outro, dude, because he's gonna refuse to come on after.
Well, no. Nah, what? What you talking about?
That's his words, is all.
I mean, that's all. Well, that's all we're saying. Well, here. He
should, like, someone should see it as a challenge. Like, hey, these guys are laughing now, but like, I'm gonna prove it to him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so. I'm sure that he's had people that have said anything to him. You know, actually, the question that I wanted to pose to him was. And I'm actually serious about this. The question I wanted to pose to him was, are these memories... Because he talks about mind control in his stuff, too. I think, Rob, you're nodding your head. I read that part, too, where he's
slowly starting to remember bits and pieces of all the stuff. Yeah. It's not like he experienced it yesterday and now he's telling people about it. It's like regressive, what do they call it? Like hypno...
Yeah, you had it right.
So, you know, I brought this up, but we talked to Nick Redfern and about the Pascagoula, Mississippi case and about BZ and all that. You know, we brought this up several times. You know, mentioned this guy named Phil Schneider. He was this guy that was on the UFO circuit back in the 90s. He actually committed suicide by somehow strangling himself with a tube. He claimed that he fought these aliens in this Dulce base. And I've often wondered if whether these were just two groups of guys that were dosed up on something in some kind of mind control experiment, and they were just one group was the aliens, one group were the soldiers, and they were told to kill each other.
Huh. I wouldn't put it past our government to do that.
So what I would like to ask Captain K is that how do you know that any of this was real, whether this was just some kind of mind control experiment in and of itself? And some of these guys that are coming out, like, not only him, there's Captain K, there's Andrew Basiago, who claims that he was a time traveler and that he was at the Gettysburg Address, and he has a picture to prove it. And also some other guys that are involved with, like, the Montauk Project and supposedly the Philadelphia Experiment, some of these guys that came out in the 90s. Whether these guys were just all mind control experiments and their brains were so fried that they actually believed all these experiences were happening to them. And through some kind of suggestion, these memories were put into their brains somehow. I've often wondered if that could be the case. That's one reason I wanted to get him to ask him that question. Because he could be one of those guys.
I really want to know more about where I was listening to another podcast I was telling you about that time. And he mentioned something about how the CIA sprayed a ghetto or some like poor community here in America. They sprayed radioactive isotopes like all over the community just to see what would happen. Just
to see what would happen. Yeah. Yeah. I've heard of stuff like that too. Use
the whole poor community as a guinea pig for the experiment.
Well, that's not you had the Tuskegee syphilis project, and actually, you know, Craig probably would have been a good person to ask this question. You know, the Tuskegee syphilis project was where they injected black men over with syphilis and observed them over a number of years to see how the disease progressed.
So, I don't know much about Tuskegee. Was that the part of the military that was all black?
Well, the Tuskegee Airmen, which is an all-black air group.
And the Tuskegee. But
Tuskegee is a town in Alabama, and it was some government organization, health organization, that injected these guys. And I believe like they dumped some radioactive isotopes in subways. That had happened.
Whoa.
Yeah, Alex Jones talks a lot about this stuff.
Yeah.
Before we go.
I miss listening to him.
Oh, Alex Jones! This actually came out, I believe, yesterday, and this is something else that we've also talked about on the show. Slender Man interrogation tapes reveal shocking new details.
Oh, boy.
In explosive police interrogation tapes, the two young girls accused of stabbing a classmate in an effort to please the fictional internet character Slender Man explain in their own words why they believe the character would come after them if they didn't kill their friend. I didn't want to do this. Morgan Geyser is her telling a police officer on an interrogation tape. I was afraid of what would happen if I didn't. I didn't want to find out what would happen if we didn't. Morgan Geyser and Anissa Wire, both now 13, were arrested on May 31st, 2014, after allegedly stabbing their then 12-year-old friend, Peyton Lutner, 19 times and leaving her to die in the woods in their hometown of Waukesha, Wisconsin. But after being rushed to the hospital with life-threatening injuries, Peyton survived. The police interrogation tapes, which were recorded mere hours after both girls were arrested, were shown at a pretrial hearing for the girls this week. 2020 has been following the case since, this is from ABC News, since it began more than 8 months ago. This past May, Peyton Lutner went to a sleepover with her friend Morgan and another girl, Anissa, to celebrate Morgan's birthday. After her arrest, Morgan told police that Peyton was her only friend for a long time, so I decided to stab her. She was my best friend since fourth grade, Morgan is heard telling the officer on the interrogation tape. But when the officer asked Morgan why she decided to hurt Peyton, Morgan replied it was necessary to please Slender Man.
Must please Slender Man.
I've always wanted to make the Slender Cat meme. I was gonna... we have a black cat, and I wanted to take one of my black socks and put it over her head. And she would be Slender Cat.
Both Morgan and Anissa were obsessed with the fictional character, who is often depicted in fan fiction stories online as a horror figure who stalks children. In court this week, disturbing drawings depicting Slender Man and dismembered Barbie dolls recovered from Morgan's bedroom were shown. When asked to describe Slender Man, Morgan told the detective on the interrogation tape that he was a tall, faceless man who preys on children. He watches you, she added. I've never seen him. He's everywhere. In the interrogation video, the then 12-year-old Anissa said, he can be anywhere from 6 feet to 14 feet tall. He doesn't have a face. His skin is white. And at his own will, he can exploit these tendrils from his back and, like, strangle his victims. Anissa is heard telling police that Morgan suggested they go in search of Slender Man and become his proxies. Morgan said, hey, Anissa, we should be proxies. I was like, okay, how would we do that? And Anissa is heard telling a police officer. Authorities say Morgan repeatedly told detectives it was necessary to kill Peyton, to become proxies of Slender Man, and live with him in his mansion in the woods. They believed his mansion was in the Chequamegon Nicolet National Forest in northern Wisconsin. Morgan told police their plan to kill their friend began as early as December 2013. Anissa told detectives she was excited when Morgan told her of the plan to stab Peyton. I was excited because I wanted proof that he existed, because there were a bunch of skeptics out there saying he didn't exist. She said, Morgan and I were going to be like lionesses chasing down a zebra. I was going to tackle her, and then Morgan was going to do the stabbing. Jesus. Anissa also told the detective that it was Morgan who convinced her that she had to kill, or else Slender Man would kill my whole family in 3 seconds. Police said when the girls were caught in 2014, they were carrying clothes, granola bars, and water bottles. One of the girls was carrying a picture of her family, telling police she wanted to remember what they looked like after leaving her town for Slender Man's imaginary mansion in the woods. The girls told police they left Peyton to die in the woods, lying to her and saying that help was on the way, and said they began their journey to find Slender Man's mansion. On the interrogation tape, Anissa described how she felt about Slender Man when they were apprehended, saying, I'm scared. I was told if I didn't do something, my family would be in danger. Both girls have been charged with one count of first-degree intentional attempted homicide. They have not entered pleas. Anissa and Morgan appeared in court this week before a judge who will decide whether to try the girls as adults or send their cases to a juvenile court. A judge's decision is expected in March. I honestly don't know why we did this, Morgan said. Wow.
Rob? I lost interest about halfway through.
I know. It's ADD. See, Rob, you know, you have two girls that are...
One's 12, actually.
Yeah. About the same age. Almost slowly close to that age.
They're very influenced by media and stuff. I can't imagine it ever getting to that point without some kind of, like, way deeper issue...
Yeah.
...behind it all.
Right. It's fascinating. I mean, it's you know, like they used to talk about how people would kill themselves because they would listen to Ozzy Osbourne lyrics or something back in the 80s, you know? And it's just... it just makes you wonder, is there some, obviously one friend was probably influencing the other, mm-hmm. and they really should look at one of those girls, to see the one that's the leader, to really see if there's some mental illness
there.
There are people that, when we've had some on this show, that would say a possibility that maybe it's like a tulpa kind of effect, and they maybe have actually have been seeing this figure in their dreams. Maybe they gave it some kind of sense of reality to them. You never know. Luke? Oh, my brain is fried.
I was just gonna say something, dude. I lost it. I lost it. It was good, too.
Well, anyway, guys, we're about to call it. I want to thank you guys for coming out tonight. Thanks for Craig Ciccone for coming in, being kind of like a almost last 10-minute fill-in guest.
The Ciccone Indians.
That's right, the Ciccone Indians. Well, next time we'll be back in about 2 weeks, and we're going to have Dr. Future on, and we're going to be like, this is kind of going to be like our,
we're going to party, I would say, and get wasted.
Yeah, it's like our 3-year anniversary, basically, because we started this back in March 2012.
Nice.
Right on, dude.
Yeah. So, like, March is going to be, like, 3-year anniversary. I've got him coming on, and we're going to talk about Jewish ritual magic.
You're going to have another anniversary, and I'm excited about that, too.
Well, what I'm thinking of is if we get to episode 100, then, which is probably a possibility at this point, we will have another party.
Yeah.
I don't want to say anything other than that. So,
Kegger.
Yeah. Oh, over here. I don't know if that's going
to
happen.
This time I'm going to have to control myself a little bit more. Though.
Yeah.
We'll have to do like Kegger in a haunted location.
Yeah. There you go.
Righteous.
But you know, I've got my mind kind of spinning on that. What we can do. But join us next time with Dr. Future, and thank you guys for listening. And next week we'll be back on
Conspiraborble.
Something. Insert something witty said by Luke here.
I'm brain dead, bro.